Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping the future. So whether you're tuning in live or catching up later, stay ahead with some of the stories that really count. Coming up on the program, President Ramaphosa walks a tightrope as the Trump showdown happens today. Can our president punch back or will he fold under Trump's pressure? Manufacturing in South Africa is bleeding and jobs are vanishing while rates stay high. We'll give you a union perspective. And can Johannesburg fix Lillian Ngoyi Street before more businesses collapse? It's Wednesday, the 21st of May. As South Africa prepares for a pivotal meeting between President Ramaphosa and President Trump, I want to reflect on the strategic importance now of this event and diplomacy and what South Africa can hope to achieve from this dialogue. And I'm in conversation now with Martin Kingston, who is Chair of Business for South Africa. Martin, first of all then, given the complex dynamics that exist at the moment between Pretoria and Washington, how realistic, in your opinion, is it to expect a meaningful breakthrough later today?
I think that it's very important, Jeremy, and I think that it's quite possible, particularly given the fact that we've seen this on the horizon for some time. The relationship with the United States has been deteriorating, you know, over many years, and it needs a fundamental reset, and President Ramaphosa is fully aware not only of that, but the critical importance of an appropriate bilateral relationship between America and South Africa, and the key levers that need to be thought through in that process. Of course, in the final analysis, it'll depend upon the dynamics as they play out in the course of today in the actual meeting itself.
Let's talk about those key levers in just a moment, but you've also suggested that he's got to focus on breaking the ice rather than securing any kind of grand deal in meeting one.
Yeah, I think that's correct. It's very unlikely that there's going to be a deal that's constructed in such a short period of time. We've seen that with other countries. Much more importantly, that he establishes and builds on a rapport with President Trump. It's got to be an interpersonal foundation to that deal, or I would rather say a set of arrangements that can be implemented over time across both environmental considerations in South Africa, trade and investment considerations, and of course the geopolitical sort of currents that are impacting upon not just us but many other parts of the world. And if they can agree a way forward, if he can take the opportunity to introduce and prioritize the importance of not only the issues but his envoy Tobisi Jonas, which I'm sure he will do in the course of the engagement, then we've got our work set out for us in the coming months. But as you say, the ice will have been broken.
I understand the importance of a cautious and even a judicious approach as far as this is concerned, but you've also got to ensure, Martin, surely, that it doesn't lead to any early missed opportunities for tangible progress. He's got to walk away, surely, with something.
I have no doubt that that's the case. When you say he, I think it applies to both President Ramaphosa, but also President Trump. The Americans have been very strident in their criticism. We know what it is, some of it completely unjustified, by the way, but we don't want to waste too much time trying to correct those misapprehensions or misunderstandings in the meeting, rather than focus on, for example, in the case of trade, what we can do for America, as well as indeed what they can do for us, focusing inter alia on critical minerals, but also issues that have already surfaced in terms of what the Americans see to be discrimination against them relative to other trading partners. The investment environment, I think we all understand the criticality of an enabling investment environment. It doesn't just apply to the American multinationals, some 600 plus that are already invested in South Africa, employing over 200,000 people. It applies to both domestic and international companies from other countries. And I think that, you know, those issues around the availability and the competitiveness of our infrastructure is just one such. The appropriateness and adaptability of our regulatory environment is another. All of those, I think, we can demonstrate a quick and easy movement on, although it'll take time, as I indicated, to implement change in a more fundamental way.
Are there specific assurances that South Africa can provide to existing and potential American investors to maintain and boost their confidence, given the concern regarding land reform in the country and the allegations of expropriation?
Yeah, so I think that that is a very easy thing to clarify. The president, I don't know whether he will be able to do it or want to do it in the meeting itself, but we're all confident, and indeed in the engagements we've had with the Americans, that the bill for expropriation without compensation doesn't actually challenge any American companies in terms of their assets in South Africa. It doesn't apply to them any more than it applies to South African companies. Indeed, the same, I would say, Jeremy, is the case with respect to this idea that there is targeted killings of a particular racial group, in this case Afrikaners. I'm not sure that that will necessarily be the subject matter of significant discussion, but we can easily provide the requisite assurances, particularly with regard to rural safety. We all know that crime and corruption is a fundamental challenge to the country at large, and business is working closely with government to try and address that as quickly as possible. And of course, the third area is that of black economic empowerment. It's a mainstay of our journey towards transformation. And there again, I think that we're all aware of the fact that there is scope for flexibility, and I have no doubt that will also be explored.
Martin, in the absence of business people accompanying the presidential team, the interests of South Africa's business community being represented in these discussions seems to be lacking. Is there concern there?
No, not at all. First of all, I don't think that he's without business people by his side. I know that it's in the public domain that Johann Rupert is there, but I have no doubt that there will be other leading business people who are with him as well. But much more importantly, Ntobisi Jonas, as the presidential envoy, has been engaging significantly and substantively with the business community. And we've agreed with him that our issues need to be at the forefront of his areas for consideration, both trade and investment. And we are, as you say, the most directly impacted in many ways, not only in the context of current potential sanctions. So, for example, being released from the benefits of AGOA, not having an appropriate tariff regime between South Africa and the US, but other sanctions that might emerge over time. I think that we are absolutely clear, both large and small, formal and informal business, as to the criticality of an appropriate relationship with the United States, and that that is being taken into consideration by President Ramaphosa and the rest of his delegation.
And Martin, finally then, looking ahead at the conclusion of the discussions, are there key indicators, in your opinion, that would signify a successful outcome?
Yeah, I think that we'll see very quickly, maybe even in the aftermath of today's meeting, whether the ice has been broken. I think that sentiment is actually absolutely fundamental. It buoys confidence levels. Confidence is a prerequisite for ongoing investment domestically and from international companies. And I think that we will see a couple of indications of breakthroughs that have taken place, if not today, in the coming days and weeks.
Martin Kingston, thank you very much indeed.
Remember when you had to hurry up and wait, and cars could only run on fossil fuels? Well, hurry up and catch up. You don't need diesel power, you just need a second electric motor. With Volvo plug-in hybrids, you can drive electric in the city, switch to fuel for the long haul, or combine both when you want it all. So what are you waiting for? You're late for your test drive. It's safe to be brave with Volvo.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
So let's continue the story now. And what techniques, I wonder, is President Ramaphosa going to have to deploy during this important meeting at the White House? Joining me now is Clive Simpkins. He is a renowned communication strategist, author with decades of experience in guiding individuals and organizations through complex communication challenges. Simpkins has worked with top executives and political figures, helping them navigate high-pressure situations with confidence. And when it comes to high pressure, this meeting certainly is one. So, Clive, a very warm welcome. In your experience, then, what are the most common tactics that are used by corporate and political bullies to intimidate others? others. What is President Ramaphosa walking into?
Jeremy, the uniqueness of his meeting with Trump is that although we see Trump as a bully, Trump does a very interesting thing. He tends to throw down the gauntlet at somebody's foot in the most unexpected way, and to use the term that they float in psychology, discombobulate that person. So he actually creates a thing called shock. And if you think of his advisor, Steve Bannon, Steve constantly spoke of shock and awe. So Trump's bullying takes a very specific form, because eminent psychiatrists in the United States have diagnosed him as being a malignant narcissist. One of the things about narcissism is they can't stand being wrong and they can't stand being criticized. And they actually, and this is the ultimate paradox, they actually have a poor sense of self-esteem. So the tactic that Ramaphosa should take with someone like Trump is, number one, start off with patting Donnie on the back and saying something like, it's wonderful to see how you've shaken up the global order with your very innovative thinking and creativity and so on. And one of the things is, you know, that the world needed a person like you right now. So this is a subtle technique developed by a psychologist by the name of Mel Sorcher, which looks for in the person something that you can genuinely compliment them on. And what Trump is needing and wanting is the affirmation and the acknowledgement of his brilliance. And I have almost no doubt that a very skilled negotiator and a very skilled former union boss in the form of Cyril Ramaphosa will know exactly which buttons to push.
Critical, of course, Clive, to maintain composure throughout that meeting, as well as clarity of purpose, if he's going to be responding to any aggressive or manipulative tactics.
Absolutely. And one thing about Cyril Ramaphosa, even though I don't like his lack of delivery on too many fronts, is he is capable of maintaining that composure. So even in a very high stress situation, his face doesn't show any sign of him being ruffled. And that's very important, because in bullying, going back to what you said earlier, there's nothing that a bully enjoys more than seeing that they've got a nonverbal or other reaction out of the quote unquote victim.
So critical that effective communication at this meeting takes place, but it's also about the initial handshake, I would imagine. The moment he walks into that room, it's about, in many ways, who owns the space. Am I right?
Absolutely. And something that I find rather disgusting is they were going to try to meet with Elon Musk ahead of the meeting with Trump and offer him a sweetener in the form of Starlink being given special privileges or in some way, shape or form to actually operate in South Africa without falling under BEE legislation. So that's a bribe in whichever way you look at it. And of course, if you sweeten the lapdog in the form of Elon Musk, then Trump is probably going to love it a bit more.
Clive, just in terms of power dynamics in the room, obviously the United States of America has home territory. It holds all the cards. Is there any advice that you would give the president in terms of managing the very grand and maybe even intimidating surroundings that he will no doubt confront?
You know, the fortunate thing is that President Ramaphosa has been around the world. He's been into grand settings before. I don't think he's going to be in awe of his surroundings. So I can't see that being a factor. The key thing there is he knows that he's got to go in, and Trump is going to be sitting there with the acronym of WIFM, what's in it for me, in his head. And if Ramaphosa goes in and cleverly offers some sort of trade deals or incentives of some sort, it's going to work. Well, Etsy Mbeki said yesterday in a column that he wrote that what Trump is wanting is for South Africa to come back into the Western world fold and away from BRICS and so on. Well, that simply is not going to happen. So should Trump try to leverage any concessions based on that, then I think one's going to run into an early stalemate.
Clive, President Ramaphosa walks into that meeting with a team, with an entourage. In a situation like this, again, with the stakes being so high, what role do they play?
I hope an invisible one, and he shouldn't walk in with a whole pile of people, because that all adds to the distraction factor. If one thinks of Zelensky's meeting with Trump, for example, with all of the other Americans sitting on those couches and things, it really creates messy optics.
Clive, just in terms of widening the scope slightly and moving beyond President Ramaphosa and this meeting with Donald Trump, big meetings like this, intimidating meetings, impact corporate leaders every single day. What advice would you have for leaders who want to model and promote assertive yet respectful communication, either externally with stakeholders or even within their own teams?
There's a very beautiful technique which is used in Tai Chi, which is called taking the inferior power position. And people like Professor Vaynon Pinnar, for example, from UNISA, who is an internationally recognized negotiator in hostage and other type situations. What Vaynon has always said is, if you consciously choose what appears to be the inferior power position, it actually poses no threat to the other people, and it allows them to feel that they have the upper hand. But in fact, it is a brilliant use of soft power on your part. So what it means is, you go in there and you're determined not to ruffle their sense of control, their sense of superiority, or their sense of superiority. And you in fact approach it with appropriate humility and high emotional intelligence and high social intelligence. And you go in there in transactional analysis terms, where they speak of parent, adult, child. You go in there to play the adult in the room.
And just finally, Clive, in a quick one, what will determine a win, either for President Ramaphosa or President Trump, if you were to put a scorecard together at the end of this meeting?
If I were to put a scorecard together for this one, I'd say if Ramaphosa is able to walk away with some sort of agreement that AGOA will continue for South Africa and benefit our farmers and agriculture and industry and enterprise generally, that would be number one. And I would certainly like to see some reinstatement of PEPFAR, which is the George W. Bush originated HIV/AIDS program. We desperately need those two things. So I'm not sure what Ramaphosa would have to offer Trump, but if he could walk away with those two things under his belt, I think that would be a magnificent win.
It is going to be a tough and fascinating meeting. Clive Simpkins, thank you very much indeed for the insight.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, with inflation at a four-year low and job losses piling up in manufacturing, mining and construction, the General Industries Workers Union of South Africa says it's had enough. The union's president, Mametlwe Sebei, is calling on the Reserve Bank to slash interest rates to 3.5%, accusing it of economic sabotage, strong words, and also serving financiers over workers. But here's my question. Is this a fix that South Africa needs, or is this just reckless policy that is masked as activism? So, Mametlwe, welcome to you. Inflation is down, but is that enough reason to slash interest rates so dramatically?
So, firstly, 3.5% interest rates is where the interest rates were in the 2000s, right? So this is not something that we thumbsucked. And many economists, including Professor Buoza, are saying this is a rate at which actually this economy was able to create jobs in the past. Now, you would understand the theory behind the interest rates is what in economics they call NIRU, non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment. It's a quite a cruel logic that basically there's a trade-off between employment and inflation. And if actually, many people have money because they're employed, they're getting too much wages, then they are pushing up prices through demand. We don't think that theory has a basis. But to the extent that they are pursuing that, what we are having now is unemployment plummeting, and that is indicative of every sector, particularly job-creating sector like manufacturing, mining that have lost 35,000, construction that has lost 119,000 jobs. And of course, the economy is also down in general. And at the same time as inflation rate is below even the lowest target range of the South African Reserve Bank itself, which is 3.6%. So it's at 2.7% at the moment. So there's no reason, there's no excuse why they should continue to be strangling jobs, wages of the workers, as well as economy and employment.
Isn't that a very simplistic argument, though? Let me put to you that global forces, like slowing demand from China, for instance, is more to blame for the collapse in manufacturing.
Well, the fact of the matter is that I would argue, in actual fact, When you look at the reasoning behind the, you know, the interest rates, right? There's no correlation between the interest rates and the inflation in this country. The idea that we are containing inflation because of interest rates is completely false. Lots of our inflation is imported, right? And insofar as the Chinese economy slowing down, Americans, you know, imposing some form of, you know, a trade war on us and all of that, it's all the more reason we should build economy that works for the people of this country, and that the motto of an export-oriented economy that is based purely on manufacturing things for Americans, for the Chinese, it doesn't work. And this is what our vulnerability at the present moment is actually about. We need to ensure workers have a decent wages. We are able to create a domestic market for manufacturing to reindustrialize the country and create millions of jobs that we need, as well as driving prices of goods and services down by a supply in this country.
No one's arguing with you that people need decent jobs, but how would you respond to economists who say aggressive rate cuts could trigger capital flight?
Well, the fact of the matter is, lots of that capital, Jeremy, is not investing in actual fact in productive sectors of the economy. What they are doing, these are swindlers, these are speculators in currency market, right? Who are at best investing in short selling a South African rest. And I think most of the South African banks, by the way, have already been sued in the US for currency manipulation. But there's a whole industry of speculators on the currency and others who are investing purely on the financial markets. But when you raise interest rates to attract that parasitic investment, you are killing the real economy. Look at the construction industry. That is directly responding to the crisis in a property market. From 2016 alone, we have lost 76% of the capacity. 250,000 jobs were lost from 2016 to what they were last year. Now, in 3 months, 119,000 jobs. Is that the price worth it?
What would your plan be to stop the rand from tanking if rates were to fall to 3.5%?
The rand is a reflection of the weakening industrial base in the country, and that what needs to be addressed. And part of that is to do two things. One is that the idea that we should be waiting for some foreign investors to come and reindustrialize this country is not realistic, particularly in a period of organic crisis of capitalism, which you see in the case of overcapacity, overproduction in all main industries across the economy, across the globe, right? You're not going to get that. What you need, as we have in the past, is a state-led industrializing policy, which in the past created ISCO to benefit iron ore all the way to production of steel, you know, creation of ESCOM, creation of Sasol to benefit coal, to, you know, generate electricity, to produce oil, all of that. That is how this country was industrialized, alongside creation of IDC as a state bank to finance that, alongside a public works program to create and build infrastructure. So what you need is to address industrialization, but also to address the poverty, particularly of the black working class, in order to create a market for furniture, for equipment, for, you know, washing machines and all of that. Things that should generate manufacturing and reindustrialization of the country.
Let me
that our industrial capacity will be simply to be supplying American and other markets is not sustainable. It doesn't work for the people of this country, but also economically is dangerous, as you are seeing in the period of global trade war.
And that's where we are going to leave it. I've been in conversation with Mametlwe Sebe from the General Industries Workers Union of South Africa.
Remember when you had to hurry up and wait, and cars could only run on fossil fuels? Well, hurry up and catch up. You don't need diesel power, you just need a second electric motor. With Volvo plug-in hybrids, you can drive electric in the city, switch to fuel for the long haul, or combine both when you want it all. So what are you waiting for? You're late for your test drive. It's safe to be brave with Volvo.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now let's move on to this. And Lillian Ngoyi Street, one of Johannesburg's busiest thoroughfares, or at least was, has become a symbol, I think, of the city's deeper infrastructure crisis. Nearly 12 months after a massive underground blast ripped through the road, businesses still remain shuttered. Many livelihoods have been lost, and questions are still persisting about how such a catastrophe was allowed to happen. More broadly, across the city, the pothole epidemic continues to frustrate motorists, undermine confidence, and raise serious concerns about road safety and service delivery. Now, with public pressure mounting and a 196 million rand repair project underway as far as Lillian Ngoyi is concerned, I want to talk now to Zweli Nyati, who's the Chief Executive Officer of the Johannesburg Roads Agency. Zweli, a very warm welcome, and maybe let's start with an update on the progress of Lillian Ngoyi Street. Are you on track to meet the projected completion timeline?
Yes, we are on track. Actually, there were a couple of site visits last week just to ensure that things are still on track. Even if you visit, you'll see the street looks a bit different from what it was 2-3 months back. So yes, we are on track, and we've put accelerated plans to make sure that we meet the August deadline that we promised the community.
The great tragedy, of course, around this was the prolonged closure significantly affected local businesses. And I wonder if you think if enough was done to support these enterprises during the reconstruction period.
Consultations have happened. But from our end as a roads agency, it's just to make sure that there is, free mobility. As much as we have, closed some of the roads for the businesses, but we have, left few spaces for people to be able to walk, considering that there are people who stay in those apartments around Lillian Ngoyi, but also considering their safety because it's a construction site and there's cranes and all sorts of machinery. So from our side as the agency, we have done so. But in terms of the SMMEs as well and other businesses, we've done consultation, and I can say that around that area, a lot of businesses have benefited because we've procured material for the projects around that area and trying to support and revive. And even the SMMEs are from the inner city itself. So economically, we've tried because we've put around 26 million of the project around local procurement and SMMEs, small businesses, on easy things like pavements, sidewalks, things that doesn't need really highly skilled expertise.
I think I'm correct in saying it was 196 million rand that was allocated to the project. Has the budget been managed sufficiently to ensure transparency, efficiency, and to make sure that you will come in on that amount?
It is being managed. I think we have learned a lesson very early in the project, and that actually kept us on our toes to make sure that we do enough balance and checks. I can guarantee you that in terms of progress, we are ahead. In terms of budget, we're still within the budget that is expected. And I don't foresee us spending beyond. Yes, one needs to take into account that we spent 2 months having rains. That also had an impact on some of the infrastructure issues because constantly every 2 days we had to drain water to the size of, a dam, as it was raining nonstop. So a lot of things were affected, but I don't foresee any exorbitant expenditures. We're still within budget.
Have lessons been learnt as a result of this incident? Are steps now being implemented to prevent similar underground explosions or infrastructure failures in the future?
A lot. That is why Lillian Ngoyi, when it's complete, it will be a symbol of progress because we will do it using today's technology, all sorts of technologies that are installed on the roads, sensors, and we'll be able to install manholes that will be able to vent. Because in other countries or in first world countries, you all know that sometimes you'll see those manholes being opened and venting, releasing the gas and anything that could possibly spark fires underneath. But also it gave us a chance to study what is underneath properly. So now we know what is really underneath in terms of gases and wires, and we're trying to put all precautions so that we don't have a recurrence of such again. And also we have enhanced safety because some of these issues are related to safety As you all know, that we have illegal mining and other things. So Johannesburg is very unique in terms of its layout and the infrastructure. So we are doing our best, and we're taking those lessons into the future so that we prevent such to happen again.
Let me just widen the lens slightly. Johannesburg residents, as you are well aware, are becoming increasingly frustrated with the state of the roads, particularly the prevalence of potholes. Are you confident that your current strategy is sufficient to address this issue citywide?
Indeed, Jeremy. Let me just start by saying, given the 150 years or 100 years of Johannesburg's existence, a lot of infrastructure, really, as it was mining boom, has been laid out. But I must also admit that we have failed in terms of proactive maintenance. And that's what we're looking at, because no matter how beautiful the road can be, like, if you don't maintain it, you are bound to hit a disaster somewhere along the line. So most of the roads that we're doing now, we make sure that we have proactive maintenance plan in place. One will also want to put it on record that one of the issues was the sourcing of material for the road repairs. Now, ever since I came in, we recommissioned the asphalt plant. Now we have high quality asphalt that we're also going to use on that Lilian Ngoyi, being tested by the lab and CSIR. So we are seeing ourselves going into the future in terms of high quality infrastructure and roads. And obviously, we're dealing with the issue of potholes very seriously. As much as we were focused on the inner city, now we're spreading back to the regions. And at least now we know that the rain is over. There can be slight progress in terms of what we're doing. But also, we've come up with a plan. We're not only dealing with potholes. We are doing resurfacing, because asphalt shortage is a thing of the past. We make our own. So we are doing resurfacing, which will give us a base layer of about 5 years without issues. Of course, out of the 15,000 kilometers of road network, it's practically impossible to achieve that in the next 3 years. 15,000 is a lot. But we're doing our best. We're prioritizing roads that have deteriorated, and we are resurfacing them. That means once we are complete with this particular exercise, it will be just proactive maintenance, and the roads will have a new lease of life in terms of look and feel.
Zweli Nyati, thank you very much indeed. He is the Chief Executive Officer of the Johannesburg Roads Agency. And that is MoneyWeb at Midday for today. We are live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening. And goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.